This is Talk Radio, a forum for new thoughts and fresh ideas, a place to learn and an opportunity to express yourself. Get involved with our newsmakers and our newsbreakers of today and tomorrow. Talk Radio invites your participation. Talk Radio is
Bill Jenkins.
Well, it's Saturday night, and welcome aboard, everyone. For the next 2 hours, we're going to take a flight, you and I, and there is no telling just where we may end up. And we're going to talk about something that flies rather well. The UFO, the unidentified flying object. Is it a part of the reality that we have, or is it a modern-day myth? Well, if you've been with me for the last 5 years, you know that it's, in my mind, not a part of a modern-day myth, but it is a reality of the world that we live in. It's very difficult for some people to realize that that is a part of our reality, but maybe we can help you understand that better tonight, give you some more facts to chew on. With me is Mr. Edwin Slade, and Mr. Slade has quite a record of looking rather deeply into this matter of the UFO. Does it or does it not exist? Ed, you're here. Is there such a thing as a UFO, and are they from other worlds?
Well, the simplest way to believe in UFOs, Bill, is probably to go out and see one for yourself.
That's always the best way.
And I maintain that the world is very highly polarized at this point, because people who've seen them surely believe in them, and people who haven't will never believe in them. So we're not here to convince anybody to change their team tonight. We just like to discuss it, admittedly, from a biased view.
Mm-hmm.
That bias is that, yes, I have seen one UFO in the past, and it was remarkable, and it got me into studying the subject as deeply as I could.
Give us a little bit, Ed, about your background, why we can listen to what you have to say and have some trust in it, that, you know, you're not just somebody who lived out in the desert somewhere and all alone by yourself one day saw a UFO. As you know, some of my colleagues say, why is it that only people that live out in the desert or they're ignorant or something see UFOs? Why don't people who have great intellect and knowledge see UFOs? And why isn't the government telling us about that? And why don't we find it in the front pages of the Times and all of these wonderful things?
Well, there's a lot of whys in this subject, and I'd hope to address all of them and give you my thoughts on it, which are personal, and I appreciate the opportunity of speaking out on the subject. To go back into my background, I've lectured and taught at the New York University in the Graduate School of Engineering for 5 years, and I taught rocket theory. I've worked in the aerospace industry, and I've helped design Bomach ramjet engines, solid rocket engines, and I'm very deep into propulsion. I was also at Colt Firearms, which gives me a background in weaponry, and been cleared for secret on it all since 1955.
Now, in being cleared for secret, Ed, can I ask you a secret? Did you find some secrets there that you secretly can't tell us anything about?
No comment.
No comment. About the UFO.
But to get into what I'm doing these days, I'm the chairman of the board of Laser Arms Company, which makes a laser device used for targeting weapons, and we sell these to SWAT teams, military, and police forces. And there are some of our units out there protecting the athletes in the Olympics.
Right now?
Yes.
I'm sure glad they're there. They do, unfortunately, have to be used at times. You also appeared before the House of Lords in their investigation of the UFO.
I think that was one of the proudest moments in my life. I was the first invited guest speaker to an ongoing series, which still continues, in Parliament in London, where a special committee was set up to investigate the UFO question. And approximately once a month, they invite someone interested or prominent in the field of UFOs to speak before the House of Lords. And my first appearance was back in November of 79. And at that time, I brought some information to the House of Lords, and we had a very, very interesting meeting. It was supposed to be a one-hour address, and as I recall, we went for 8 hours without a break. My wife was outside waiting for dinner, and I couldn't forget the circumstances, yeah. But there was no way of disengaging.
I think it's interesting that the British Parliament is concerned about are they wearing white hats or black hats. They seem to feel that there are such things as the UFO. In fact, there's been quite a controversy in London about how much money the government over there is putting into UFO research.
Well, the
secretly.
The position of Parliament was that of an open inquiry, and there were no holds barred. It was a very illuminating and exciting forum, which still continues. And the chairman of the group is Lord Clancarty, who himself has written several books in the field of UFOs. And I have never seen such a well-informed, prestigious group of listeners. When you realize that among the audience was the head of British intelligence, MI5, and Admiral Hill Norton, who was promoted to the Lord of the Fleet and was in charge of the entire Argentine operation. Those are pretty eminent people who came to listen to what an invited speaker had to say about UFOs.
But here in the United States, the Congress will not touch the matter. Anytime information comes to them from our government sources concerning the UFO, it's totally censored. You know, our government is saying there's no such thing as a UFO. Here are our documents, and you can't read any of them because they're totally censored.
Well,
which, of course, is a catch-22.
I wouldn't say the Congress is totally unaware of this. There has been one or two good investigations. The Rouse Committee about 15 years ago looked into the matter. In fact, I have a page from the report, which was published through the Bureau of Printing, which classified about 72 shapes of UFOs that had been observed until that time. And that's a very interesting document. The publication was limited, and you're lucky to ever see a copy of it. But there has been some inquiries. But you're right, the general tone of the nation has been to submerge the subject of UFOs to a subject of folly, and it really hasn't...
Quackery and cultism.
Well, yes, that's been the general overview. But to people who are serious researchers and go out and do their own investigating in the field and have their own information, it's a very serious subject.
Well, before we take a little break here, would you agree that UFOs indeed are real?
I would agree that they're real. And as I say, Gallup polls have shown that approximately half the population agrees that they're real.
Would you agree that the government has been covering up the existence of UFOs and at a very costly price?
Well, if you're asking that question, I have to answer in a way that's fair to both sides. I think the government, when presented with the first UFO flap, had a very hard way to go. And they chose a certain public attitude. And being an eminent nation with a public policy, having chose that attitude, they really never changed it.
To this day?
To this day.
Keep it secret. Keep the folks' heads buried in the sand, and more or less about that. We'll take just a break. I'll be back with Alan Slade just to see. It is Edwin Slade, who has been deeply involved for many, many years now in the matter of the UFO, the unidentified flying object. We've heard stories, Ed, that some of those things have crashed and that the government has the remnants of the craft and some of the occupants on board. Is that so?
Well, Bill, you're always good at asking tough questions. And let me say this. I would speculate that the answer to that is probably yes. That there have been published reports of craft that have crashed. There have been published reports of occupants taken and that are still preserved. And as a researcher, I've collected testimony, and I've collected affidavits of people who have seen crashed vehicles and occupants, so that I believe that there were crashes, although I have not seen a crash personally. And trying to unravel the many questions you've already asked, I think it's wise to start somewhere. And when you start somewhere in the subject, you have a choice of starting to
take any point on the circle, I guess.
You have a point of starting at the time of the Bible or before, or continuing up through the many reports through the Middle Ages, or recently the flaps that occurred during World War II, where pilots saw Foo Fighters in the sky, and taking it on to the real wave of reports that came after the first atom bomb was detonated on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to break the chain of reports and start somewhere, because it would take you 6,000 years to summarize the reports.
Well, just for the fun of it, then, let's start with the earliest known reports.
Oh, well, that's easy.
And bring them up to date.
That's easy. I can go back into antiquity and refer to two sources that are really, really ancient. And both of them contain references to UFOs or flying saucers. By the way, the flying saucer name was given by Ken Arnold when he saw a group of saucer-shaped objects flying over Mount Rainier in 1947, thereabouts.
Yeah.
The earliest references that I've been able to come up with, one is very interesting, is by Hesiod, the ancient Greek author who wrote the Theogony. And the Theogony is a story of all the Greek gods, about 300 in number, that landed and descended on Mount Olympus in Greece in prehistoric times and founded the Greek nation and the Greek panoply of religion. And Hesiod's book, if it's reread today, is very compelling and very exciting, because Hesiod said that he was a shepherd who could not read or write and was minding his sheep. And the way he got the story of the family relationships of all the gods was that the three muses came to him, and by staring at him and never speaking, they transferred the thought that they had in their minds to his, and he was compelled to write the story, even though he was illiterate and could not write. He was controlled mentally by the three muses, who appeared in white garments that glowed. And with their intelligence, the story was created. And that is his preface to the book. And to this day, of course, any great artist appeals to the muses for success in his artistic endeavor. It traces back to the very first ancient writing.
Isn't it interesting that that very same type of technique of writing was also employed by the writers of the Bible?
The technique has been employed many, many, many times. And only now, by reexamining history, do you find how frequently it occurred. Almost the same story was relayed by the originators of the Mormon religion. When Joseph Smith was at home in bed, a lady in a glowing white robe came into his bedroom and compelled him to write his holy book. The story is very reoccurring in history.
But it doesn't end with religion, as we were talking at dinner tonight, you and I.
No.
Nikola Tesla also had this very same kind of inspiration, as it were.
Nikola Tesla, who was the Yugoslav scientist who came to America and made it his adopted homeland, was awarded over 200 patents, and most of them were in the area of electricity and magnetism. He is the inventor and father of alternating current, which we all use without giving a thought to Tesla.
Right. The generator, the dynamo. He even invented the electronic signal that we're using at this radio station. Not Marconi, but Tesla.
Yes, Tesla's inventions were legion. I felt it important enough when I studied Tesla to go back to his homeland and went to his university. He graduated University of Graz in Austria. I just took a detour once to visit that place, to see a building named after him, to try and get the feeling of Tesla, who was so profound and creative in his inventions, and who made so many great statements that you have to think of him in connection with UFOs, because he predicted a lot of things that UFOs can do now, and that's what makes his science interesting.
And we are just now beginning to understand the science of Tesla. I'm going to take just a break, and we'll be back with Edwin Slade on Open Mind. We'll surface with Edwin Slade about the UFO tonight. We were looking into the past references of the UFO. It goes back to, well, not only biblical times, but certainly the times of the ancient Sumerians. Even the ancient Chinese talked about it, the ancient civilizations in the Indus Valley. That's certainly a part of their lore. The civilizations of North America is a part of their lore. Even down in the island nations of the South Pacific and Australia, it's a part of their lore. I wonder where they got those wild ideas about strange circular craft flying through the sky.
Well, and to summarize all the ancient history, Bill, and this is a study in itself. I mean, you could spend your entire life researching the scriptures and the ancient references, but to summarize them, Hesiod wrote the descent of the gods in his book Theogony to Earth, and all our knowledge of the Greek gods are from that original source. He wrote the book by automatic writing, by the intercession of the three muses, and we have that book. It's in our libraries, fortunately. We could refer to it. The reason I got to Tesla was because I was trying to say that Tesla, in his later years when he was up around 80 years old, after he was awarded all the honors and had all the fame a person could ask for, he confessed in a public speech in New York that really none of those inventions were his, but that he simply went to sleep every night with a pencil and paper next to his night table. And when he awoke in the morning, there was the next patent, all drafted, written up correctly, and he had no recollection of writing it, but it was in his handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, when he was in his 80s and had no fear of censure or public ridicule, he said that he had no evidence, but he always felt that he was a controlled being, controlled by extraterrestrials who were manipulating him. And it's interesting that he said that because he invented the radio-controlled airplane.
Mm-hmm. A radio-controlled boat is what he first started with.
Yes, but he felt he was radio-controlled, mm-hmm. and he admitted he had no evidence. It was just intuition.
The things that he wanted to give mankind, or be the channel to give mankind, were enormous. Unfortunately, he got stopped by Wall Street, J.P. Morgan in particular, who felt that giving energy, for instance, to the world was an insane thing to do. That's something that you make money off of and tax. And there's where his troubles started. And because of the actions of Wall Street against Tesla, his name was even removed from textbooks. And I found it incredible to find a college professor the other day that teaches electronics in college. Never knew who Nikola Tesla was. Thomas Edison, they know all about.
Well, Thomas Edison invented the direct current or transmission mm-hmm. lines in New York, and Nikola Tesla invented the alternating current, and they were competitors. And since they both used transmission wires, you're right, it was taxable and it earned income for the owners. But Tesla claimed he could transmit energy to any place on the earth for free without wires.
Well, he was about ready to do that. He was just going to resonate the earth and let the earth do it. Let's get back to flying saucers after we take a break. Tesla we could go into for hours. We love him and the fact that his science is booming again, unfortunately. It is booming in the terms of awesome weapon systems that make the hydrogen bomb look like a little firecracker. But that is happening. Back with the UFO with Edwin Slade tonight. Where else have we seen evidence of it?
Well, I wanted to summarize the evidence in these two ancient writings because most people have access to these books and they can do their own examination of the history. In Hesiod's book, Theogony, there's a very curious chapter. Something that's really gone unnoticed by UFO fans, and I came across it, and it was quite interesting. I'd like to share it with your audience. Hesiod refers to the place where Zeus lives in the sky. And he says that he lives in a floating city. Now, we've heard the floating city before in Revelations, in the Bible. And in the Bible, it's called the New Jerusalem.
It's also in Genesis, where it landed.
There's some very curious references to it. But in Hesiod, Zeus is reported to live in the sky. Hesiod remarks that if you take a very heavy anvil and you drop it over the side of his city, it will fall down to earth, and after 9 days and nine nights of falling, it will strike the earth. That's a very interesting statement in view of our current modern rocket technology, where we could do that experiment. Anyway, it's a simple calculation to compute the height that Zeus's city is located at. And it's somewhere on the order of 3 million miles.
So there's a city out there 3 million miles away.
Well, Zeus could have been in that city at that time.
Well, have we found that city? I mean, 3 million miles is not far for fine radar and electronic astronomy and all of that sort of thing. Have we ever seen anything like that 3 million miles away?
Categorically, I can say yes.
I thought you might be able to explain that to us.
Well, before I explain it to you, you'll have to explain to me why there's no public discussion of this subject.
We're talking to hundreds of thousands of people about it tonight. I think one of the reasons there's no public discussion of it is quite often these things have already been checked out by government and they don't want you to know anything about it. One of the great thrusts of the government is to keep the sheep's heads buried in the sand concerning the UFO and any scientific data that might support anything about it.
Well, then I'll keep my discussion to the open literature,
okay,
which is open but concealed. Let's put it that way. Let's say that we're looking for something up there 3 million miles away, and we wonder where it is or what it could be. So you go back to the literature, and you find that in the 1930s, Carl Jansky, an American scientist, constructed a radio transmitter on a frequency band of about 14.3 megacycles. And he pointed this to various areas of the sky, and lo and behold, he received an echo.
Got the signal back.
Yes. Interestingly enough, the echo was amplified.
Very strange for 1935.
Yes. And he made some private notes of this. And by the way, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for radio telescopy. He is the father of radio telescopes.
Uh-huh.
This was very curious. The work didn't receive much attention. And after Carl Jansky died, his notebooks mysteriously disappeared. So the subject was very quiet.
Who took the notebooks?
Well, there's been an article written in Astronomy Magazine about 2 years ago or 3 years ago saying that when he died, strange-looking government men in black suits removed his personal effects.
Our government people would remove his government, his effects?
Well,
our CIA or one of those groups?
That's the allegation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not important because this object in the sky was rediscovered.
Oh, who rediscovered it?
A Scottish astronomer named Lunan, L-U-N-A-N. And he brought it to the attention of the scientific community that if you point your radio telescope towards Cassiopeia and emit 14.3 megacycles, you get an echo that's amplified with about a 26-second delay, which puts that object out at around 3 million miles in the vicinity of the ancient city of Zeus.
Isn't that amazing?
It's curious.
What part of the sky is Cassiopeia?
Cassiopeia.
That's near constellation Bootes, or Boots.
Well, I don't have my star chart in front of me, but the coordinates are published.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused enough interest that there was a conference called the Bukharan Conference held in Russia around 1972-73 to address this problem.
The Russians are interested in UFOs.
I think the Russians are interested in science, and yes, they have an active curiosity of something that's observable.
What happened at the conference?
Well, several scientists attended, and there were some publications that followed. And you would say they're open, but they're hidden. Mm. There was an article in the Hungarian Journal of Physics in 76, which claimed that this, in fact, was an ancient object, and it's been called the Lunan object. It really should be called the Jansky object, but it's called the Lunan object. And it's proposed by eminent Hungarian scientists that this is a radio beacon in the sky that has been there certainly since Jansky and probably certainly in the prehistory of the world. And the purpose of this is to transmit signals, amplify them onto the next radio beacon in the sky.
A radio buoy in the sky.
Yes.
3 million miles away.
That's the Hungarian conclusion, and that's the open literature which is hidden, because how many people read the Hungarian journals in Hungarian?
Now, this information has been passed on to some of our leading scientific people here.
Absolutely.
Some of our leading institutions that would ordinarily involve themselves in that kind of research right here in the Los Angeles area, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
What do they say?
Very little.
Hmm.
The subject is dismissed quickly, silently, and without much comment.
What does that mean?
Well, it certainly doesn't mean that the intelligence community of the world is stupid. It means the intelligence community is very smart and very aware of what's going on, and I'd like to make that clear to the public, having dealt with various branches of the community in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You have to respect their sources of information and how quickly they respond to events.
But why don't they want the people to know about it? After all, the people are spending billions of dollars on all of this each year.
Yes. Well, there's a conflict, I think. Once you delegate science to someone, it becomes a specialty, and he becomes the high priest of the science, and it's hard to share everything with the congregation, although you depend on the congregation to support the high priest.
Well, maybe the congregation needs to start putting pressure on the high priest to get off of it.
Well, I have personally proposed the Lunan object as a viable mission to examine. It's certainly within the realm of our technology to send at least a remote control satellite or spaceship up to that area, take some pictures and send them back.
Wouldn't hurt anything.
No, but no interest. And I think if you're really intelligent, you have to conclude that no one wants to do that because they've probably done it already.
That could be.
That could be.
It couldn't be the money involved. Not when they can spend $4,785.18 on a screw that we can buy for 3 cents. So money, of course, is no object.
No, but it's one of those things that slip through the crack in science, and it's something that I think should be discussed. It's one of those enigmas within a paradox that keeps popping up when you examine UFOs and the extraterrestrial implications.
You know, what I want to do, Ed, you know, it's so sad we only have 2 hours to do a show like this, because you and I can sit and talk. We could make a 24-hour show out of this, I think.
My personal record is 4 days and four nights.
4 days and four nights? Well, we could do that too, I think.
I think so.
I'm going to take a little break here, and when we come back, I want you to touch on some of the salient points that you want to touch, and then we'll turn it over to the audience, who I know and see on the computer is already, they're lined up out there a mile long. But in speaking to the audience right now and talking to Ed Slade, one of the things that we don't want to get into are flying saucer sightings that you may have had. You know, we could fill up a day with that. We know about the sightings. There are hundreds of thousands of them. We feel that it's time to elevate the discussion a little bit further as to what this is all about, what this means, what can be done to get it more in the open, and other questions of that nature that you may have.
You see that the research into antiquity produces very interesting things, and I wanted to mention that people are familiar with the Bible, and there's been many published references to extraterrestrial and UFO events in the Bible. They're well known. But something that's less well known is that along with the Bible, there's a book called the Zohar, which is really a companion book to the Bible. And what the Zohar is an old oral tradition that fills in on those subjects that are not in the Bible. And the origin of this story is supposed to be an oral tradition that Adam handed down to his children, especially to Seth. And this oral tradition was given to Adam, as so the story goes, by the angel Gabriel. And Gabriel came to Adam's rescue when he was ejected from the Garden of Eden. But what's so curious is that on the very first page of the Zohar, it says that the gods came to earth in a chariot. And the word for chariot is Merkaba. And the Merkaba is the UFO. So we have the reference to the Merkaba on the very first page of one of the most ancient traditions handed down from Adam. And we have it in the most ancient Greek book, discussing a flying city or a Merkaba or a city in Hesiod. And the Merkaba, by the way, is the name of the Israeli chariot, the main battle tank that they use today.
Sort of an inside joke with them.
It's an inside joke. The name is still preserved out there in the field in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought I'd bring that to the attention of some of the audience who's probably know some of these pieces and haven't put it all together yet.
Moses wrote of it too, as we've discussed on many occasions with Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden here in their book Heirs of the Gods, which talks about this very same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the city that landed near the present site of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very entertaining and cultured to talk of the ancient writings. It gets a little sticky when you talk of the modern writings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could see why. Tracing the history of the UFO impact into the United States political arena, I think a good place to start is World War II. And I brought with me today a copy of the Los Angeles Times, which was dated in 1942. I could get you the exact date if my eyes were a little stronger. This is a reduced photocopy of the newspaper.
I think it was sometime in the spring of 42, shortly after Pearl Harbor.
Anyway, the headline is, I'll get you the date in a minute. Ah, yes. It was in the Los Angeles Times and then reproduced in the New York Times edition February 26th of 1942. And the headline was Los Angeles Area Raided. And the photo that was included was a whole bunch of flying circles in the sky with searchlights, and shots were fired from anti-aircraft batteries in Los Angeles.
It was the big battle of Los Angeles.
Yes, and of course it was blamed on the Japanese. However, the military report, which I have a copy of, which is a memorandum to the president by George Marshall, General Chief of Staff, said no bombs were dropped, no casualties among our troops, no planes were shot down, and no American Army or Navy planes were in action. But there were shots fired and searchlights illuminated the circular glowing objects for the residents of Los Angeles to see.
Camouflage zeros to look like flying saucers.
Well, that's the way it started. As a result of that, the press was relatively uncontrolled, and one of the conclusions that George Marshall made from his research was that this was an extraterrestrial threat. This became apparent after persistent Foo Fighter reports appeared in World War II. And I have a quote that was made by General George Marshall, Chief of Staff.
The music means we have to go. Can you hold the quote until after the news?
Certainly.
And we'll get back to it. Remind you that all of our numbers end in talk. We're back into hour number two tonight of Open Mind. My guest is Edwin Slade. He's an industrialist in Las Vegas. He has spent a lifetime studying the UFO, has appeared before the House of Lords, has on and off again top secret clearance. Some of the things Edwin just won't talk to us about tonight. Wants to confine his remarks to things that are relatively open to maintain his stature. When we left you, Edwin, we were talking about what George C. Marshall had to say about the UFO.
I was just about ready to quote the illustrious comment of General George Marshall, Chief of Staff for the U.S. Forces, and then the Secretary of State. And I was about to quote his controversial statement, and I'm happy to report that in the break that we just had, I received no calls from Washington. no voices on the other end of the line. So I'll continue.
They don't listen.
No, they're listening. They're probably listening to us right now and running our voices through a voice analyzer to see if we have a lie. That technology is here now.
You know. Oh, yes, I know about that.
Okay. Well, George Marshall said, quote, in 1955, in a press statement to the media, that the United States authorities had, that's past tense, had established the fact that flying saucers were manned visitors from outer space. And these visitors were trying to work out a method of breathing and staying alive in our own atmosphere before landing and establishing contact, unquote. Now, that's a very exciting statement.
That's from George C. Marshall?
That's from General George C. Marshall.
And where did you get that statement?
That was published in the media in 1955. It received national distribution.
Hmm.
Now, when you said before, what's the government's position? Well, in 1955, that was the government's position. And, you know, I tend to agree with George Marshall. I think he's a hell of a nice guy, and I think he shares a lot of the opinions that I have.
He was in a rather elevated position in government.
Yes.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I think, at that time.
Yeah. So he has claimed that United States authorities had already established the fact that these sources were visitors from outer space. And there was a lot of evidence. Remember, that was after the Washington flaps where they sent up armed military aircraft to intercept UFOs flying over the Capitol. And U.S. pilots engaged them in combat, and they were shot down. There were some celebrated incidences at that time that received a lot of notoriety. And there was a spirit of honesty in the government, and let me tell you where the honesty came from. At that time, the United States had won World War II. We had a feeling of invincibility over those years. We had nuclear weapons. And I think the United States wasn't afraid of anything until the UFOs made their presence known in very, very important ways. And the U.S. realized in those years, those formative years, that they were dealing with an issue that in which they were really outclassed.
Technological superiority.
Supreme technological superiority. And it was quite obvious to the powers in government and in the military that they were dealing with an opponent who could fly at enormous speeds, who could become visible and invisible, who could do things that no one heretofore could do as a human. However, all the events that took place in those years were repeated from stories in the ancient literature, because anyone who's read the Odyssey by Homer knows that Odysseus was protected by the force field shield of the goddess Athena, who protected him from spears and arrows in battle, and who had glowing robes and could make herself invisible, and Perseus could travel the earth at lightning speed and rescue the damsel in distress, Andromeda, and had all the same technology that the UFOs have today. So after recounting the ancient scriptures, it was clear to most scholars that we were just witnessing technology that had been in the ancient mythology, because it had been seen before on Earth, but very long time ago.
I think General MacArthur in that same period had some very interesting things to say about the threat from the sky.
Well, General MacArthur said a lot of things which history will prove to be true, but it didn't make him very popular at the time, as we all know. But on October 9th, you're right, on October 9th, 1955, he published a statement in the New York Times which said that the nations of the world will have to unite, for the next war will be an interplanetary war, and the nations of the earth must someday make a common front against attack by people from other planets. And that's very heavy. That's very heavy to publish that, sign your name to it, and let everybody know that's your true position. That was General MacArthur's
position. We've had reports that he wanted to wind down the Korean War as soon as possible because the real threat wasn't there, it was elsewhere.
Well, as evident by this statement, he was aware of the interplanetary threat, and it concerned him. And it's one of those concerns that a supreme commander has, that he is powerless to implement against such superior forces.
We say the word threat. Have we any instances where there was a unprovoked attack, or have the incidences that we know of where violence has ensued been actually the result of having to defend themselves?
Well, in the hundreds of thousands of reports that have been collected, I think you can find an example of almost everything. But in general, there's no overt hostility initiated by the UFO visitors as a first response. It's generally a counterattack based on hostility from an earthly source.
Or what could be taken as a hostile act.
I mean bullets.
Yeah. Bullets and rockets.
Bullets and rockets prompt a retaliation, generally.
For a while, it seems that there was a standing order to try to shoot one down on part of the Air Force.
Well, yes, there was. There was a great desire to capture one of these vehicles, and that's...
Now, if they didn't exist, why was there a standing order to try to capture one?
Well, starting around the middle of the 1950s, it was apparent from these two statements from the Commander-in-Chief and General MacArthur and George Marshall. I mean, it was apparent that there's something up there, and we don't know how to deal with it. And I'm sure in those days that it was a soul-wrenching policy on the part of those individuals who had to take a public posture. Because look at the alternatives. If they said, oh yes, we get these interplanetary visitors from time to time and we're powerless to do anything. I mean, that's probably the silliest statement that a government could make.
Doesn't do much good for the national psyche.
Right.
Also, I think it would require, the people would all at once be wanting the government to spend their time, effort, and money doing other things other than what they're doing, which would upset a lot of apple carts.
It was very uncomfortable to admit your own weakness publicly, and it was also uncomfortable to have to lie, because here we were, a proud nation on top of the world, and someone had to say, well, if we don't lie, at least we can double talk, which was a compromise.
Not really.
it was very awkward, very awkward. I tell you frankly, I wouldn't want to have been in the seat of government in those years to try to make policy, because there is no policy that's really successful.
Well, of course, now it's a matter of... doesn't make any difference, but it seems to me that the most prudent course of action, and maybe it's the 2020 vision of hindsight, would have been to candidly reveal to the American people what was going on and marshal the genius of the American people, which is a great deal, in order to deal with it and what way it had to be dealt with.
Well, that's one approach, and I'd like to comment on that. If that was done and everybody was geared up to study the UFO problem openly, I think there was wise voices in government that said, now, wait a minute. We invented the atom bomb. Next thing we know, our enemies have it, and our power is compromised. So this time, let's not make the same mistake. Why don't we, like, keep this little secret in within the club? And let's not tell everybody our inner thinking and our inner research, because then our enemies might beat us to the punch. And I think that's a military consideration, and I think it's valid. So, you see, that's another approach. So then came the decades of ridicule. And, you know, ridicule has its effect. You can ridicule the UFO right out of the scientific literature, and that's exactly what was done.
Well, and you hear respected journalists, for instance, some of them on this radio station say, if they are real, why is it that nobody ever sees them except little old farmers out in a field somewhere or people with not too much IQ? But that just happens to be a statement not grounded in fact.
You know, this is something I never really mentioned to anybody, but if he wants to see one, there's ways to see one. In my travels, and I travel the world a great deal, believe it or not, I met an uneducated fellow, just a young boy. He was in his 20s. I met him in Europe. In Europe, and he had a story to tell me that was quite amusing. He said that in his little village in Sudan, a UFO comes periodically and lands in his village about every 5 years. He had seen it on a previous visit, and it's taken quite normally by the tribesmen in his village. And every 5 years, they meet each other, exchange gifts, shake hands, and they drive off after a short visit. And you know, I mentioned this to a lot of people and said, hey, if somebody wants to see a flying saucer, they should spend 5 years in Sudan, and they probably will. But no takers.
No takers on that one. Speaking of uneducated people who've seen them, Jimmy Carter, well-documented episode when he saw one.
Oh, yes, I have a lot of the press releases that Jimmy Carter made when he was governor and promised as part of his platform that when he's elected president, he would reveal the entire UFO cover-up to the American public.
And that ended that.
Well, he never did. And it saddened a lot of the UFO enthusiasts. But, you know, there are reasons for everything. And the reason, looking back, has to be that the technology of the UFO being so exciting and far advanced was tried to be held proprietary by those people who were looking into the matter. And you do have decades now of virtual silence from the establishment on anything positive about UFOs. But my comment is, having traveled to the other side of the world, you have the exact situation in the Russian camp.
They're operating under the same rule book.
Same rule book. Very active underground research, quiet, secret research. Many, many observations, many eminent scientists involved with it. The Academy of Sciences and Felix Zygel is over there, and very good scientists in charge who say nothing to the public that's very meaningful, but you know that there's great interest on both sides for obvious reasons.
Well, from the crashed ones or the retrieved ones, there's a treasure trove of technology if we can just figure it out.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so we're trying. We're going to get to our callers here in just a moment. Let me give you the numbers again. In Los Angeles, 5 to the UFO. We'd be glad to talk to you. Edwin Slade is here. We'll be back in a moment. Edwin Slade, and see what's on your mind. And just keep it on the UFOs. We have Brian on the line. Brian, welcome aboard.
Good evening, Ed and Bill. I had two main questions to ask. The first one is about the UFO's propulsion system. Could Ed comment on that?
I'd love to. What's your question?
I'll tell you a little bit what I think about it. I think that electromagnetics has a part in their propulsion system, and that they expound great amounts of electromagnetic energy, and the Air Force, I'm sure, knows about this, and that it's a lot of times it's in the microwave region of the spectrum. Could you comment on that?
Well, yes. Great thought has been put to the propulsion system, and I can tell you from my own investigations that there's a lot of possibilities here. I would think the primary power plant is probably atomic fusion. And I can tell you why I think that. The one of the most energetic reactions in the world is if you collide two nitrogen atoms together, and technically that would be N14 plus N14. That would give you magnesium 24 as the ash, and helium as the combustion product, the fusion product. And it's a very interesting reaction because nitrogen is plentiful, and that reaction gives 17 million electron volts per collision, which is enormous. And operating in the atmosphere, you could scoop up nitrogen and fuse it and get all the energy you need. In fact, I figured out once that a 10-foot sphere of air would get you up and back to the moon 30 times just based on energy consideration. And so the primary plant could be fusion, and there's a lot to support that. If you have such a plant, you're going to get radiomagnetic byproducts. And a lot of victims who've gone and reported they've been near these craft when they were under power did get a microwave type of injury. And there's many, many reports like that. So, yes, you know, the fusion secret is a secret that's sought after. And all the fusion research going on is very much influenced by UFO data. There's the Project Sherwood that was going on for many years doing fusion in Princeton, and the fusion research in Russia is the Tokamak project, both of which I think were inspired by UFO type of reports.
There's another technology that they could use. People that listen to this program probably know about T. Henry Morey's technology that he developed that was able to produce large amounts of electrical energy and in a very small, compact type of space, you could produce large amounts of electrical energy. They from the information that I've gathered up there, they produce enormous amounts of electromagnetic energy, and from calculations and things like that I've read about, that just in a hovering mode, they're producing as much energy as a diesel locomotive can produce easily.
Yes, there are these technological advances, and I'd like to just say something that should be said. There has been published reports that it takes enormous amounts of energy to do the UFO mission.
Mm-hmm.
And the Condon report that was issued by the U.S. government said that. And it's not necessarily true, because if you figure out the minimum energy to do a mission, and you mention the hovering mode as one mission, that doesn't take any energy, and you could prove that thermodynamically. But it's a miracle. I mean, you take a 30-ton UFO and you make it hover, and it doesn't cost any energy. Now, how do you do that? Well, that's the secret that...
That's the main dark question.
Yes, that secret hasn't been published, and if it's discovered, it hasn't been mass-produced. So you could say that the secret is still a secret, and there's no real device that captures that secret and exploits it yet.
There is also something else, too, that's uncanny about their ability, is that there's, of course, other things involved in this, is their ability to fly through the air at great, tremendous speeds and not create sonic booms.
It's interesting you mention that, because my background is very strong in that particular subject, and that is a wonderful mystery, because whenever you take a ponderable object and put it through a fluid or gas, you do create a shock wave if you exceed the sonic velocity. In the case of UFOs, this doesn't happen. The only conclusion you can draw from that is that there's a force around the UFO which opposes the air molecules.
Yes.
And pulls them back into where the original position so they don't start a sonic boom. And that force is not clearly understood. It's really a puzzle, and it's an unsolved puzzle at this point.
It may indeed have something to do with their propulsion system.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. It would have to, because it would, you know, when you make a sonic boom, you waste a lot of energy. And not being able to make sonic booms and disturb the air would be a great benefit.
You know, the fusion idea is certainly supported, I think, by a story we have right there in front of us. It came out of the Soviet Union, and looking at the great blast in Siberia in the early part of the century, which was an atomic explosion.
The famous Tunguski crater in Siberia. Oh, yes, much has been written about that. Bill, I know you're referring to something most of our readers know something about, but there was an enormous explosion in the early 1900s in Siberia, fortunately, and trees were knocked down for 20, 30 miles, and the sound was heard for 200 miles. And the Russian literature says that that 1908 explosion may have been caused by an explosion of an extraterrestrial visitor's power plant that went bad and exploded, because their eyewitnesses saw the trace of the vehicle going upwards before the explosion. So it wasn't a meteorite coming downwards. And there is radioactivity in the forest still.
Still today.
The second question that I want to ask,
I want you to make it very quick. Yep. We have a lot of people here.
Is could you tell us anything about their metals technology? Obviously, that they're very not only highly advanced in physics, but they're very highly advanced in metals technology too.
The metals technology is truly wondrous, and I would like to answer that. Eyewitness accounts have said that the vehicle is a silvery color. There have been eyewitnesses who've touched the vehicle, and when you touch it, it seems to ripple like mercury. The metal is like fluid, but it's a metal. It also has another property: when the energy is turned on and the power plant starts up, that at different times the metal becomes transparent, so you could see through the metal into the cabin. At other times, it's metallic and you cannot see through. Conversely, there have been human eyewitnesses from the inside of the UFO who say at certain times in a power cycle they could look out and see the world uninterrupted by the metal. And it's an amazing thing.
Is it true the Air Force has a sample of some of these metals and they can't figure it out, period?
Well, now you're getting into touchy ground. Is it true? If you ask the Air Force, you'll get an answer.
Yes, of course.
The Russians would like to know the answer, too. I can tell you there's been many published affidavits that people have made saying that vehicles have crashed and that the remains were recovered. And they were stored in various locations in the United States. Yes, that's been published, and I would comment on a report like that. The more important thing here is in looking at the technology, it's apparent that the eyewitness human accounts of this technology is really beyond our present understanding.
Yes, still very far beyond.
My comment, however, is that if you look at the atomic structure of metal with a nucleus and a few electrons, it seems logical that light would go through the open spaces very easily. A photon being so tiny would go through a metal, and it's more logical to think that a metal is transparent than it is opaque. So it's to a scientist, it's not unbelievable that metals can be transparent.
Okay, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your questions. We'll be back with more. Edwin Slade in just a moment. About UFOs, and we are talking to, where are we? Jerry, right now. We're talking to you.
All right, Jerry. I mean, Bill.
Yeah.
You got to have a longer program or a shorter speaker, one or the other, because we've got a lot of questions we want to ask this man, and we can't get on soon enough.
We're trying to get a longer program.
I hope so. Okay, my question is this. Since your guest believes in UFOs, or at least it sounds like he does, I assume he probably does believe that beings, or resurrected beings, could travel a distance and do the same thing. And my question is this. He made a comment at the top of the hour, at the beginning of the show, that Angel Moroni had visited Joseph Smith. And because of the brightness of his garments, or the brightness of him, it reflects along that line. He made a mistake, and I think he did, and I want to correct it for him.
We know he did, yes.
Angel Moroni was a male,
right,
and not a female. And secondly, I do concur with him on many things he said tonight. I also wish to say that there's a city of ink. Now, he has talked about a gentleman that has gone to a city. They think he's gone somewhere out there in the heavens. And I am, of course, a firm believer that the city of ink does exist and was lifted off this earth and does exist out there in the heavens. What does he know about that? And how does he feel about that?
Well, I have to agree with you, Ed. You missed our intimation where I said, oh, my goodness, I had the wrong gender to the angel, and I only did that because I was thinking of the muses. I'm well aware that Moroni was male, and I did correct myself to Bill privately. I said I'm
that he did.
I'm sure we're going to get a question on that, and it's terrible, but it's one of those unfortunate slips. Cities in the sky is an interesting subject. I don't have any intelligence of the city of Enoch to give you, but the city of the New Jerusalem is mentioned in Revelations, and if you read the text, it claims that at the end of the world, this city will descend upon Jerusalem and save the righteous people and then depart.
He was there before. He was there during the time of the garden.
Do you believe that this friend of, or the person that you were talking about earlier in the program could be in that city possibly?
Well, you know, the questions of whether there is a unique city or many cities is unanswered. I feel from the evidence that there are many such cities because they seem to have different languages, different cultures, different city, different histories, different parts of the population are acquainted with them. I think there are several cities. That's my opinion.
All right. Let me make this last statement because there's hundreds of people waiting for you. If you read the Book of Mormon, it's in that book, and it covers that. And I thank you for your guest, Bill.
Jerry, thank you for your call. Appreciate it very much. You know, you'll find Hillshire have Jeff on the line. Jeff, what's on your mind tonight?
Well, I'd like to speak about my theory on UFOs and a little bit about the fact that, okay,
I want you to make it very quick.
Your guest has been talking a lot about how the American government is covering up a lot of this stuff. It seems to me that us Westerners are really very ignorant to a lot of things that are going on as far as psychic phenomena. Now, what I'd like to say is, the past 4 years, I've been experiencing a very new phenomena. I don't know if your guest has heard about it. It's called astral projection. And this phenomena can be reached through meditation.
We just were talking about it with the Monroe Institute a second ago.
Okay, now, do you think, through your travels, have you experienced or heard anything on the subject of, through meditation, being able to get in touch with these beings? From what I understand, astral projection is a phenomenon of vibrating your fluid body, which is inside your physical body, at a level quick enough to communicate with these UFOs.
Jeff, it's a great question. And I'd love to talk all night on the subject. Let me give you the answer you're looking for. In the ancient Zohar, which I mentioned, which is a kind of companion to the Bible, it's Adam's story that was given to him by Gabriel on the history of the world. There's a chapter dealing with that question. And it says that at midnight, precisely at midnight, the angels fly over the earth and collect all the thoughts of the sleeping people below. And they do it at that time because in the Zohar it says people who are dreaming cannot lie. And the angels collect the true thoughts of each person and relay that information to God. And that is how God knows the true state of the world.
Yeah.
Now that's such an ancient commentary that it bears directly on your question. If you consider the brain as an electric transmitter of a very low intensity, it's possible that brain wave signals can be transmitted to the heavens, and it's also possible that a device could collect those thoughts, and it's also possible they could be relayed intergalactically by radio buoys or sounds in the sky, and it's possible that someone is listening.
Right. But you could monitor the mass consciousness of the world that way.
Now, what about the phenomena of astral projection or the phenomena of soul travel, which they study in India? Now, if you are familiar with the science of Ekankar, they believe that if you vibrate at different levels and tune your mind into certain sounds or something, you can vibrate your spiritual body quick enough to get to these different levels. And as far as Ekankar is concerned, which is the Tibetan ancient study of soul travel, they believe that on the astral plane, which is the lowest plane and the closest plane to the physical plane, that through meditation, you can get to that next plane. Do you think these, now, through my experiences, you didn't want to talk about sightings, but through astral projection, I have gone to the astral plane through meditation and have seen UFOs, which Ekankar also believes they exist at that level. Now, do you believe that they can vibrate quick enough and slow down that vibration of the atoms to disappear and,
move interdimensionally, you're saying?
Right.
Well, let me comment in the following way. If you consider the brain as a transmitter, then you can transmit, and by self-thought, I think you can alter your transmitter to do different things. And I think that if someone is listening on certain frequencies, they could also beam signals back. And I think the brain could be a receiver as well. So, in answer to your question, the analysis of the brain as a radio transmitter allows for all of these possibilities. However, we're at a point now where we're getting insight into it, but we haven't really documented these things in a very reproducible way that can be commercialized and exploited. Certain people are getting closer to the secret. It's a very exciting and interesting subject, and I would not dismiss it.
But do you think that's
it.
One of the closest theories to the secret? That being so materialistic about it?
I think...
Well, you think that's part of what the government is trying to hide?
Well, there are a lot of researchers that believe that they do move interdimensionally, if that is one thing. This space frame into an excellent.
I tend to think that this is a Pandora's box. Once you admit that there's a UFO, you have to admit there's a pilot. Once you admit there's a pilot, you have to consider where he comes from. Then you have to consider what he's doing and what his mission is. Now you look at his tools and then you look at his technology, and it goes on and on and on into a Pandora's box that is so exciting that it could go on forever. It's really a subject that you can penetrate
right.
So many ways.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's one of the major researchers, right?
They're trying it, certainly, in all of that.
Right.
And I think the official position is to play down all of the speculation and business as usual and...
Keep your mind on the Olympics and other things.
Keep your mind on fun and games, really, because it's very deep and very provocative. I just allow what's allowable under our scientific knowledge, and that is, you study things that are possible.
Okay, Jeff, listen. Jeff, we've got to go. Appreciate the questions. They were very good. And we'll be right back with Edmund Slate.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Got Jimmy Carter on your mind,
huh? Right, yes. I'm really not familiar with the subject at all. And when I heard about the Jimmy Carter incident, I have no idea what that was about. And I'm really interested in hearing about it.
Well, you just came to the right place.
Okay.
Yes, our former president certainly saw a flying saucer. Go ahead there, Ed.
Well, I have a copy of Jimmy Carter's report to NICAP that he made when he was governor, and it's interesting, he made the report on September 18, 1973. He says here that his occupation is governor. His special training is in nuclear physics, the U.S. Navy. He says that he made the sighting, however, many years before. Date of observation, October 1969, and the locality was in Leary, Georgia, shortly after dark, and it goes on to say that it was as bright as the moon, and there was only one object, and It's a rather lengthy NICAP standard report where the object was sharply outlined and about the same size as the moon, maybe a little smaller, varied from brighter than the moon to apparently the size of the moon, and 10 to 12 men all watched it, and he was outdoors waiting for a meeting to begin at 7:30, and it goes on and on.
Oh, my God.
A very interesting thing, and part of, he signed it here on 9/18/73, and his quote during the campaign was, "I'll make every piece of information that this country has about UFO sightings available to the public. I am convinced that UFOs exist because I have seen one." Unquote. Now, you know, there are a lot of people who wrote letters to Jimmy Carter and said, "Please don't tell us about UFOs," but I'm sorry that nothing really came publicized as a result.
Well, he had
of
a change of heart, similar to Saul of Tarsus on his way to Damascus.
Exactly.
Yes, once he became president of the United States and
exactly.
had to confront the security community.
But
who slapped his wrist about those campaign promises?
You know, truth will out, and I think that if people are curious enough and follow the record enough, I'm sure that eventually these apparent secrets will come out. There are records, and they're kept. And patience, I think, is the byword. And one day, the true story will be known.
We certainly hope so, and that's a good note to end it on. Thank you very much, Tom. We didn't have time to get the hold of Craig, who's been on the line, but time is all gone, Craig. Edwin Slade, thank you very much for dropping in and sharing a tip of the iceberg of what you know of the UFO. You'll have to come back, you know.
I hope we can continue someday, Bill. Thanks very much for this opportunity.
Stephen Schwartz next week with me. See you.